What are the success factors that contribute to effective campaigning?
In terms of success factors of a good campaign as it develops and as it's being planned, I think there are a number of important principles. You know, the first one being absolutely clear about what you're trying to achieve and building in an evaluation process even right at the beginning and testing the extent to which those objectives that have been identified have been achieved. Other principles, I think, if I could perhaps just pick out two more that I think are really important. Firstly, ensuring that you have that an organisation has a very clear route to change, very clearly identified process within which they want to try and influence decision makers. You know, well-developed understanding of what will influence targets, whether they're political targets or whether they're target audiences, target publics. And the second and final principle, I think, is, and this is quite challenging, I think, for many organisations, but having the confidence to sometimes decrease the resources that you apply to a campaign. It doesn't necessarily have to be running at a full capacity all the time. Good campaigns, in my experience anyway, have natural peaks and troughs of activity.
What kind of tensions, if any, do you see between fundraising and other kinds of campaigning work?
At the outset, it's probably worth saying that in many charities, small charities particularly, these sometimes are indistinguishable disciplines, and that often it's the same individual working on fundraising, policy, research, campaigning, parliamentary and press. However, for larger organisations, medium and large-sized charities and non-governmental organisations, my experience is that there is a fair degree of tension, because I do think that they're two fundamentally different disciplines with very different objectives. Some of the methodologies and some of the approaches might be similar in terms of identifying clarity of objectives and target audiences, and I think increasingly, I hope, a discipline that certainly we're trying to instill within campaigners that I think fundraisers have had for a long time, which is assessing the return on investment of resources. Now, that return may be different. It's not a fiscal return in campaigning terms, but it might be a policy change or degree of policy change. And I think there are some, therefore, using that as an example, some similarities between fundraising and campaigning. And there may be some convergence as well at a kind of low common denominator level, I think, about organisational positioning and brand, which is helpful in both terms, both in income-generating terms, but also in political positioning for campaigning terms. However, in my experience, and I'll give you an example, one of the tensions that manifests itself is the mobilisation of supporters and donors, in that my experience is, from a campaigning perspective, that fundraisers are quite naturally and understandably nervous about a campaigning ask, write to your MP about this particular issue, if that through testing that particular campaign action may suppress income from those same supporters. Of course, it's important to say that without fundraising, campaigners couldn't do the work that they do as well, I think.
Have you got any examples of how organisations can manage tensions like that successfully?
I think it's only through successful negotiation internally. And, you know, there are some examples of where those sorts of tensions have been managed through organisational development and even restructuring, so that there is one, you know, command and control over those different disciplines. I think the ways that organisations have reconciled those tensions have been largely around brand and positioning. So, I mean, the example, I suppose, that is quite well known would be the Full Stop, NSPCC's Full Stop campaign, which was primarily around generating income, giving, you know, new supporters coming into the organisation who would then be mobilised subsequently to take action to try and protect children against cruelty.
How can smaller charities and voluntary organisations punch above their weight in getting noticed and creating impact?
My experience is that large doesn't necessarily equate to impact. Just because an organisation has greater resources doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to use them in the most effective way. It may well be that because the organisation is smaller, their resources are finite, and they have to think, and they do think more carefully about the way in which they deploy their resources. And those principles that we talked about earlier about being clear about what you want to achieve, identifying very clearly who the decision makers are, building coherent strategies to try and influence those decision makers, and also having the flexibility and agility of a small organisation means that they have much more impact
I'm particularly interested in ways in which charities and other voluntary organisations can use collaboration to make more impact. Have you got any examples of that working in practice?
Working in collaboration, which manifests itself in a number of different ways, strategic alliances, campaign coalitions, even loose networks, is a really interesting and very important trend, I think, in that increasingly organisations, I think, have realised that to maximise their resources, maximise their potential for impact, they're not necessarily going to do that in isolation, and they need to work with partner organisations as part of wider civil society in order to influence change effectively. And you only have to look really at a number of quite diverse issues to see that almost all of those issues, Stop Climate Chaos, Jubilee Debt Coalition, the Landmines Coalition that campaigned together, many different issues now have coalitions at their heart in terms of the way that the sectors are working together. I think that's a really interesting trend. It presents different challenges. I mean, in some respects, you'd think, would one on the face of it, that's a very positive thing. But hidden within that can come some quite significant transaction costs. And by that, I mean the negotiations that different organisations then have to have between themselves in order to agree a particular agreed policy position, for example. The other thing I'd just add as well to campaign coalitions, alliances and networks is some of the most effective coalitions and alliances have been cross-sectoral. And by that, I mean they're not just within the charity and NGO sector. They can also bring in other sectors, faith organisations, trade unions, being two examples.
What would you say are the secrets of using the media effectively?
I'm not sure that there's any particular secrets. most media strategies have two elements to them, and it's important for an organisation and a campaigns manager to think about two elements. Firstly is the proactive, and by that, that is the way in which an organisation, perhaps working with partners, places media stories at particular times to try and influence opinion formers and decision makers. So that could be through the launch of a report, or it could be through a particular event or seminar, or it could be through even a stunt in campaigning terms. And that's the proactive side, which is much easier, obviously, by definition, to manage. What's harder, and I think in any good media strategy that's obviously complementary to other strategies, it's also important to protect and preserve some capacity for the reactive. And obviously this is a particular trend in recent years because of 24-hour news coverage, and if also in terms of media, one might also look at new technology and the rise of internet and blogs as well, which is reactive. You know, you're approached by either a journalist or a correspondent to make a particular comment about a particular story that may or may not be relevant to the campaign. And given the rise of 24-hour news coverage, that can be quite a drain on an organisation's resources, particularly if it was a small organisation. And the challenge, I think, sometimes is to be confident enough to say, no, we're not going to comment on that, and focus on delivering an effective campaign strategy.
Are there ways in which organisations can prepare themselves to respond better to those sorts of approaches?
Through a good campaign planning process, it'd be really important, I think, to identify the scope of the campaign. And I would always suggest to organisations and to press officers in this case that they talk to colleagues and thought about what were the objectives of the campaign, because it's very easy to be sidetracked into a particular discussion and debate that a journalist may want to have.
How can organisations evaluate the effectiveness of their campaigning?
What's really important is to put evaluation at the beginning of a campaign. Too often we're approached by organisations to say, can you help us evaluate this campaign? We go in and look at their campaign plans, and of course they haven't set very clear aims and objectives at the beginning. So it's really difficult, if not impossible sometimes, to evaluate that.
You've mentioned the importance of having clear objectives for a successful campaign. Can you give us an example of how to articulate an objective really well?
There's been a lot of thought, I think, put into this, and the tried and trusted method traditionally has been trying to phrase objectives as being SMART, which I think I've seen different definitions, but I take to mean specific, measurable, achievable, relevant and timetabled. I think the Some of the more recent thinking, though, is that that can be a little bit inhibiting for organisations, and there isn't that much evidence, in fact, of good, smart campaign objectives being written. What I think is perhaps more useful increasingly is that we try and communicate perhaps measurables useful and achievable, particularly useful. So those two aspects of those five may be more useful.
Where do you see the future in campaigning, particularly in reaching new groups of supporters and donors?
Campaigning is at a really interesting place historically, I think. Most organisations established their campaigning functions, particularly the medium and large organisations, relatively recently. Campaigning is a new discipline. Oxfam, for example, 1986, established its campaigning unit. So it's only in the last 20 years or so that campaigning as an organised voluntary and community sector discipline has started to become established and started to think about where it's going. So campaigning is at a very interesting time. I think there are a number of different trends that are quite useful and interesting for the sector to think about and take on, one of which is the role of new media and new technology.
Do you think those sorts of technologies have a better chance of mobilising new groups of supporters? I'm thinking particularly of younger supporters who then might become lifelong supporters of a particular organisation or charity.
I suppose my concern would be about that, in my experience, would be that organisations have, as one of their objectives, engagement of young people, which I think is... I think organisations need to think about the resources that that might need and might involve to do that in a sustained way. I think it's one thing, perhaps, seeking their fiscal support over time, recruiting and retaining them for that. I think it's another thing to mobilise them in relation to campaigning support.
You've mentioned what you see as the trends in a United Kingdom context. Yeah. I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts about how that might play out in a European or more international environment.
One of the, I think, most interesting things about the way in which international global civil society is mobilising is you increasingly detect that that's happening at a regional level. So there are a number of different regional institutional policy-making bodies, obviously the EU, the African Union, or even within Africa, the SADC, the Southern Africa Development Committee, in Southeast Asia, SEAN. And I think there's a number of different legitimate international, intergovernmental bodies that are coming together to make regional policy. And as a response to that, what you do see, and we see this quite a lot in NCVO's international work, is a range of international civil society organisations responding and cooperating across borders. So as policy making has gone increasingly regional, so civil society has responded in a way that I think means that they're much more interested in engaging cross-border, bilaterally across different states and trying to influence the policy making process at a regional level.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris Stalker.
Thank you.